Welcome to the Energy Markets Podcast. I'm Brian Lee, and today we're going to discuss what former FERC Commissioner Bill Massey, in our first episode of this season, termed the Battle of the Statistics. Since the inception of competition in electricity at retail, monopoly advocates have pointed to power prices in the dozen or more states with retail choice to argue against competition in this last monopoly standing industry. And as long as you didn't dig too deep into their methodology, it was an effective PR campaign. But they were comparing apples and oranges. Joining us to expand on this is Rich Spilkey, Principal Retail Market Development with Constellation Energy, who is joining us today representing the Retail Energy Supply Association. Rich, Exelon and Constellation merged after I had left the company, so I didn't get to work with you there, but I did get to know you from my time as a media relations consultant at RESA. Thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Brian. I'm very eager to share the information we have. I'm thrilled to have the chance to try to add some clarity.
So I like to think of you as the Steve Kornacki of retail energy. Kornacki is the khaki pants wearing, sleeves rolled up journalist with NBC who breaks down the polling and voting statistics for viewers on election night. He does a great job of taking nerdy numbers and graphically presenting them in an accessible way. Now, we're an audio only podcast, so we can't have you at the big board, as they call it, but let's do our best to paint the pictures and graphs with words. You're carrying on the legacy of Phil O'Connor for RESA. Phil was a former Illinois utility regulator and consultant and an important advocate for retail competition and energy. Tell us about Phil's work that you're carrying on for RESA.
Yeah, that's a great starting point, Brian. I met Phil in 1999. I started to read his testimony, particularly in Illinois rate cases, even prior to that in the mid-90s, but I had not met him yet. I just knew him as a an advocate for competitive markets and a advocate for competitive choice. I was already admiring his work from a written point of view, and then I admired him even more, once I got to meet him, and then I actually got to work with him for, quite a number of years after that. So he was the one who definitely brought me forward. I knew how to crunch numbers, but he tried to illuminate me and educate me on the importance of, bringing the numbers in a vivid way. And before there was restructuring, in the, say the 90s, it was, we'll have to call it a theory. It was a theory that a competitive market would work better than a monopoly structure. And that theory was predicated on other examples, the trucking industry, the airline industry, the telecommunications industry, and several others, where that had worked out for the good of the economy and for the good of the country. And so that's what Phil and others were kind of basing the premise on. But as the years went by and as I continued to work with Phil into the teens, the 2010s and the teens, and then Phil passed away in late 2018, Phil would encourage me, to look at, we now have almost 20 years of data where the competitive states have done certain things, where the monopoly states have done certain things. And let's add it together. Let's add it together in a big, giant, weighted average form, like all the monopoly states added together into a big pile and all the competitive states added together in a big pile, and just measure everything. Generation bill, generation performance, price performance, renewable performance, emissions reductions, reliability, everything. So that's what, Phil encouraged me to do, and which we've done and continue to do even since his passing away, and expanded upon that kind of idea. And the results are remarkable. We'll get into it here in a minute. But, it's also interesting because what's happened in the last, 20 years that has, affected our entire country, not just the competitive states and the monopoly states. I mean, when you think about the shale gas revolution and how that completely turned the generation market upside down, with the abundance of inexpensive natural gas that our country experienced. When you think about what Phil called the flat load era from around 2008, even up until the present, really, how the load has been flat, relatively speaking, compared to the decades before that, when load was just going up by incremental percentages year after year after year, and the impact that's had on the monopoly markets compared to the competitive markets. The interest in renewables, clearly the interest in renewables and also the technology of the renewables themselves. Both of those things have been going on. And what's interesting is, and again, I'm not an economist, but if I were an economist, it would be fascinating because everything I just talked about has been going on in monopoly states and in the competitive states at the same time in the same country with the same currency, with the same economic, you know, environment. Yet the competitive states in almost all cases are handling these things in a superior way compared to the monopoly structures. And all the evidence we have and gathered, you know, kind of proves that. And so it's fascinating to me that, you know, for whatever reason, the arguments that you even pointed out to yourself a moment ago in your introductory remarks, but well, you know, the prices in the competitive states are higher than in the monopoly states, you know, therefore we should not embrace competitive markets. I mean, yes, people still cling to that anecdote. And it's just, it's fascinating to me because that's not what we should be measuring. We should be measuring the, you know, changes that occurred when you change the form of regulation from a vertically integrated traditional rate-based approach to a competitive one. That's what we should be measuring. And if you measure that, holy cow, what a difference it makes.
Let's talk about the methodology. I think the methodology was first applied only in terms of price by the Compete Coalition. That was when I was there, Bill Massey was counsel to Compete. We were running into this price argument. We were 10 years into the competition at retail, and the price caps had only just come off in the last few years at that point. We didn't know how this experiment would work because what we were faced with was primarily the American Public Power Association. APPA would and still does point to prices for municipally owned monopoly utilities being cheaper than prices in the competitive regions. And of course, that ignores the fact that prices were already cheaper there to begin with, even before competition had been put in place, largely because the cost of financing for a municipal utility is much lower given their tax-free status. But their reports that were prepared for them to make these arguments on price were a case of garbage in, garbage out. They would include in their list of competitive states those that had moved to competition but had reversed course. States like California, Michigan, and Virginia were included in their methodologies. And they would compare prices between these two buckets of states or two buckets of regions or two models statically as a snapshot in time rather than over time. It's the price trend over time. If you're going to examine the change in prices over time, you need to adjust for inflation so you're not perpetuating the apples to oranges problem. And so at Compete, we decided that we would take a look at this. We would take a look at what are truly competitive states versus states that still had monopoly structure, and that we would adjust it over time. And I give credit to Scott Brown, who was my report to at that time, for agreeing to this and for making the money available to do this first time look at this. And we were 10 years into competition, and I was amazed. The results came back from the consultant. We saw a clear trend where prices in the competitive states were coming down, whereas prices in the monopoly states were going up. We're now more than 10 years past that point. We're about a quarter of a century now into competition. Phil took that methodology and expanded it to not just look at price, but to look at real important factors such as innovation and that sort of thing. Tell us about Phil's reports.
Your audience can't see this, but if they go to the RESA website and they look at the Phil O'Connor Thought Leadership page, they will see what I'm about to show you here. So there was the first paper that he wrote, let's see, called Restructuring Recharged.
Yeah, so the first one was called Restructuring Recharged. The second one was called The Great Divergence. So
that's correct.
Let's go ahead and flesh this out.
They're both similar, but restructuring and charge was first. And it's so important to define what constitutes a competitive state versus a monopoly state. So this little chart that I'm showing now, or this little map that I'm showing now on the screen, basically shows what we define as the 14 competitive jurisdictions.
So what we're looking at is most of the Northeast, except for Vermont, and Illinois, with a little gap in between Illinois and Ohio, because Indiana is still a monopoly state.
That's correct. And so the definition is shown here. I got the two bullet points, you know, showing here on the screen adjacent to this chart. In order to be considered a competitive state in this, on this map, to be, you know, green colored, I guess, amongst the 14, two conditions need to be met. One is that all customer classes are able to choose a retail supplier without hiring a lawyer or reading complex tariffs or, you know, negotiating some special arrangement with the utility. It's just a matter of business practice. You can just choose your retail supplier. And again, even there, I got to be even more technical. Not that I want to be, but, you know, we have to be. In these states that we color green, it's the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, that have to allow their customers to choose. The co-ops and the munis in these states sometimes allow choice, but usually not. They're usually exempt, and they usually don't permit choice. So even in a state that we call green, competitive, there's still, you know, segments that cannot choose their retail supplier because they're in a co-op or a muni. So just to clarify that. And then the second, and probably maybe even more important point to become a green colored state, is that the utilities in these jurisdictions, in these states, have divested all or almost all their generation and no longer own the generation. It's no longer in the rate base. They're delivery service only utilities. So if those two conditions are met, we call them a competitive state. So when you talk about Virginia and California and Michigan, those are dark gray on this map. We call those hybrid states, where they're still vertically integrated monopolies. The utilities still own the generation. They're still getting a guaranteed rate of return. Customers, for the most part, cannot choose a retail supplier. But like in the case of Virginia, for example, there are certain loopholes that allow certain large customers to choose a retail supplier if they meet certain criteria. But generally speaking, the vast majority of customers cannot choose, and the vast majority of the generation in those hybrid states is still, you know, vertically integrated with a guaranteed rate of return. So they're still monopoly states, basically, you know, even though they're dark gray in color.
So to describe this map that folks can see on the RESA website, if they want to pull it up while we talk, these are shaded dark gray. So you've got states like Virginia, Montana, and much of the West Coast, including California, where there's extremely limited choice and effectively no choice for the average customer.
Exactly. And even like using California as a great example, yes, there is what they have. They have what they call the lottery process in California, and certain C&I customers can choose their supplier. But even then, those customers that are able to choose have to pay large stranded cost charges. They call them PCIAs in California, just to be fancy. But, you know, they're paying stranded costs on the utility-owned generation assets that they're no longer using.
Wait a second, Rich. 25 years ago, when California allegedly opened its market to competition, the utilities were allowed to recover their stranded costs. And most of them had effectively recovered their stranded costs by the time the market collapsed because it was so badly designed. So Now they have to pay stranded costs again in order to access a competitive market?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a number of customers that we do serve in California, and they have to pay what's called, they don't call them stranded cost charges. Like I said, they call them PCIAs, but they are effectively stranded cost charges, and they have a very complex mechanism for determining the, you know, based on the year that you entered into the market and the year you started shopping. But they do have stranded cost charges. They call them PCIAs. They have different years that change the number and change the calculation, called vintages. But yes, you're paying stranded cost charges. They're continuing on with that trend. The point is, though, that when someone says that California is a competitive state and should be included in the competitive group. I strongly oppose that assertion or that idea, because again, they don't meet either of the criteria that we just outlined about having the ability to choose freely and about not having the generation owned by the utilities. So clearly California is a vertically integrated monopoly state for the most part, not just for the most part, you know, they don't meet either of the criteria, so they should not be in the competitive pile. And in fact, the prices in California, you know, are sky high. You know, I think largely not because they have a little bit of choice, but largely because they don't.
You know? Yeah. What happened was they screwed up the market and they entered into very, very high priced contracts to get out of the situation and saddled their customers with those costs for a couple of decades. And this gets to what I was saying and describing the APPA methodology and critiquing that. They were including states like California in their comparison papers. So go on.
At the end of the day, that's why we define the way we define the competitive states. I think it makes perfect sense. I think it's a fair way to group things and a fair way to compare things. So our definition is clearly defined here. We make it clear. We don't make it a mystery. We show what the criteria is to be considered a competitive state. It has to do with who owns the generation and which customers can choose and which ones can't.
So to try and short circuit the description of the methodology, though, so this is important. Get the right states so you're not comparing apples and oranges. And then the price data comes from the Energy Information Administration.
Yes, we take the EIA data. Now, the EIA data is, you know, independently gathered by the federal government, and they've been doing it for perhaps 30 years or more. And the it's as good as we got. But the problem with it, I mean, it's not ideal. I mean, I admit it's not ideal. It's as good as we got, and the trends are definitely captured. But the EIA data does not separate. I mean, I wish it did. But it does not separate the delivery services, which are still a monopoly function, the wires charges, from the competitively procured energy and capacity and ancillary markets. It does not separate those components. So that's unfortunate. So all we can do is combine the bundled costs, you might say, you know, where it adds everything together. It still shows that the competitive states are doing, you know, a much better job managing the costs. It doesn't separate the wires charges.
Well, let's explain why that's important, because when you're a utility and you're no longer making money from generation, you're making money through the wires charges. So you've got an incentive to load your costs into the wires charges so that you get a rate of return on there. And we've seen a real spike in wires charges in recent years.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I wish we could separate them, because I think it would show the competitive states doing even better than they already are compared to the monopoly states. If we could filter out the wires charges that have gone pretty high in most of the, you know, in all states, but in the competitive states in particular, because of the reasons you stated, Brian, you know, because now the utilities there, that's all they got. They is the wires. They don't have the generation anymore, you know, by definition. So, but if you look at this next chart, and again, I know people can't see it, but if you look at this next chart that I'm showing you, again, this is, again, zeroing in on price. This is the inflation adjusted weighted average price performance by customer class.
Rich, let me interrupt you before we get to this graph. The third piece of the methodology is not comparing this EIA price data between these two buckets of states statically in a snapshot in time, but looking at it over time and adjusting for inflation so that we have an apples to apples comparison, right?
That's right. We do it both ways, actually. We do it with it without inflation adjusted. The chart I'm showing now is inflation adjusted, but we have the data, you know, without the inflation adjustment as well.
And so on this chart, we've got competitive states on the left. This is titled Inflation Adjusted Weighted Average Percentage Price Change by Customer Class, Choice versus Monopoly States. And this is 2008 through 2022, which is I guess 2008 is chosen because that's when price caps came off, and you've got a real, you're actually looking at the effect of competition at that point.
Well, that's another really great observation, Brian. Right. Why did we pick 2008? There's many reasons why Phil picked 2008, and I'll explain most of them. We can pick any number you want. You know, Phil predicted that people would nitpick that, and he was right. People do nitpick the starting point. But let's talk about why it was chosen. But I'm happy to pick other years. And I have data for every start year and every end year if you really want your mind to be baffled by 1,000 different data points. But anyway, why would you pick 2008? There's like four reasons, maybe five. Reason one is that's when stranded cost charges stopped being collected. That's reason one. Reason two is that that's when the flat load era that I described briefly earlier began, or, you know, about then is when it began, give or take a year. That's also when the shale gas technology started to assert itself or started to have an impact. That's also when the renewable technologies and the renewable interests started. And it's also, I guess here's the fifth reason. The fifth reason is that that's when residential customers first began to shop in a manner that was approaching, you know, it was probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%. It was less than that prior to 2008. So it started to show up on the screen as a percentage, in the 5% range in the competitive state. So all five of those reasons are reasons why Phil picked 2008 is a good starting point because it captured all those contributors or those metrics. That's why we picked it. But, you know, I have data as Phil predicted that people would say, well, you picked 2008 because it makes you look good. No, we didn't pick 2008 because it makes us look good. We picked it because it made sense to pick it for the reasons I said. But I have the data, if someone really wants to study it, with every start year and every end year you can imagine. And yes, there's a few little exceptions where the monopoly states might have done better if you pick a certain start year and pick a certain end year. But the vast, vast, vast majority of the start years and end years show that the competitive states are doing a better job.
When we first did this at Compete, it was 2010. And so we looked back over a decade and the price trend showing increasing costs in monopoly states, decreasing costs in competitive states, was apparent even then. So in continuing the description of this graph, so we've got the two states, competitive states, monopoly states, and we've got multicolors showing costs going down for the competitive states and costs going up for the monopoly states.
Absolutely. Yep, that's true across the board. And it's for the different rate classes that you're seeing the different colors here, which may not be discernible on this small scale.
And you've got it broken down into all customer segments, residential segment, commercial segment, and industrial. And this is really demonstrable.
Well, I think it's remarkable. I like to talk about this chart a lot because the picture says 1,000 words. So yes, clearly just glancing at this chart, there's something good going on in the competitive states. Price-wise and cost containment-wise, that's not happening in the monopoly states. And again, remember, shale gas is happening across the country. The renewable technology is happening across the country. The flat load is happening across the country. All those things we talked about, all those trends are happening in the monopoly states and in the competitive states at the same time over this time period. Yet, look how the competitive states are dealing with it cost-wise and cost containment-wise. Compared to the monopoly states. I mean, it's clearly there's something good going on in the competitive states that kind of leaps off the page when you look at this chart. And I want to also talk about residential, because residential, Phil used to say that the residential competitive market is maybe only 10% of the business, but it's 90% of the politics. If you look at the red color chart here on the chart, which is the residential grouping or the residential class, yes, it's clear that the residential customers are not benefiting as much as the business community is, as the non-residential customers are, but they're still benefiting compared to the monopoly states. What I think the data shows us here is that you know, in a lot of the monopoly states, the residential customers have been subsidized because you can do that in a political environment, you know, in a monopoly structure. We are allocating costs in a political fashion. But when the subsidies come off in a competitive market, which is what's happening here, you know, naturally the business customers are benefiting disproportionately because they're no longer subsidizing the residential customers the way they used to. So I think what we're seeing here is that the subsidies have been removed. The residential customers are still winning. They're still winning quite a bit. But the business customers, the non-residentials, are winning proportionally more because they're no longer subsidizing the residential folks. I think the data is showing us that.
Yeah. So we've got a real strong trend line here on price. But I guess what Phil did with this was to expand it beyond price, to look at the things that are really more important than just price, which is access to clean energy and innovation, et cetera. Do you want to expand on that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've zeroed in on price, and that is, you know, we can't get away from it. People do want to talk about that. So that is captured here. And we got a lot of charts that, you know, measure that to that. So here, so the second paper he wrote, we got away from our little guidance here, was called The Great Divergence. But, you know, just as the name implies, The Great Divergence is talking about, you know, the price trend between the monopoly states and the competitive states. We've already covered that, but I just want to point out that he wrote this second white paper prior to his death that was published, you know, right before he passed away, actually. And that just zeroed in on this great divergence, this price disparity that we're talking about. And it shows, you know, the millions and billions of dollars that the competitive states have benefited, that the monopoly states have not benefited from.
Stop scrolling for a second, Rich. So we've got a couple of graphs here. One is a line graph, one is a bar graph. The first one shows unrealized savings for 35 monopoly states equals $630 billion. And the avoided loss by 14 competitive jurisdictions equals $430 billion. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, so what we're doing here is we're saying, hey, if the monopoly states, which is shown by the black colored line and data, if they would have behaved price-wise and performed price-wise the way the competitive states did over this timeline, in other words, if they would have also restructured and followed the same trend, they would have saved $630 billion. So that's what we call that unrealized savings. They didn't save $630 billion because they didn't restructure and they didn't behave that way. So they, you know, they might have saved $630 billion had they restructured and acted like the average competitive jurisdiction did. And then on the flip side of that coin, the competitive states did perform the way the competitive states performed. And so if they would have acted like monopoly states, they, you know, they would have paid $430 billion more. So they save $430 billion because they didn't act like monopoly states and they acted like competitive states, you know, as they were. So that's what we're trying to say.
So the bar graph shows all sector price percentage change by state from 08 to 22. And it shows the majority of monopoly states cluster in the upper part there. In other words, they had the greatest percentage price increase. And the competitive jurisdictions tend to cluster in the lower range. In other words, that they had the best price percentage change. You want to expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we're trying to show. So, you know, if you look at it state by state by state, you clearly see, as you described verbally, that on the right-hand side of the chart, which is the lower price changes, and in fact, sometimes they're negative. They're, you know, prices have been going down in some of the competitive states. It's clearly showing that the competitive states are clearly on the right-hand side of the chart. And there's like one exception. I can't see which state exactly that is. There is one competitive state. It might be New Hampshire, the one we were talking about a minute ago. I think it might be New Hampshire that's an exception where they haven't done quite as well as their brethren in the competitive grouping. But, you know, but generally speaking, you know, all the competitive states, with the exception of New Hampshire, are on the right-hand side of the chart. And all the monopoly states, you know, there's a few on the right-hand side of the chart, but most of the monopoly states are on the left-hand side of the chart. So it's not, you know, a perfect, it's not like the competitive states always beat the monopoly states, but generally they do. And this chart kind of captures that idea.
It does show the clear trend line, which is that prices have been increasing for states that maintain monopoly regulation. And we've got better price regulation, better control of costs going up in the states that move to open up their markets to retail competition. Let's talk about how Phil took this methodology and expanded it beyond price.
So yeah, so price, we've beaten that to death. This is a figure I'm showing now about what we call capacity factor. This is more of a wholesale measure. But when you have competitive markets and you have the generation owned by non-utilities and they are not getting the guaranteed rate of return, the cost of that facility is not in the rate base of a utility, and those generators have to compete, you find that they end up operating them more efficiently and more, they're utilizing them in a more cost-effective way, which is a lot of where the price savings is coming from, which we have already covered. A lot of it's coming from the competitive wholesale market where the generators are being operated in a different way because they're owned and their performance is measured in a different manner because they're not in a rate base. There's no guaranteed rate of return. So we measured the capacity factor. We measured, if the generators are even, getting built at all without a guaranteed rate of return. So we have charts that demonstrate, because I remember one time I was in a monopoly state. It was actually Indiana. You mentioned Indiana a minute ago. But it doesn't matter where the idea came from. But I remember the person challenged me and they said, hey, prove to me that in a competitive state without a guaranteed rate of return, that generation gets built based on market signals alone. And that person challenged me. And at that time, I didn't have the data and it really made me think. And I brought it back to Phil. I brought that question back to Phil. And anyway, we have the data now.
So change in capacity factor, that is probably one of the most important elements of how competition has improved things for electricity consumers. Just look at what happened with nuclear power capacity factors. Before competition, the average nuclear power plant had a 60% range therein of capacity factor. Today, given that the vast bulk of nuclear power plants operate in competitive markets, there's a strong incentive for them to operate as much as possible and to minimize downtime. And you've got phenomenal capacity factors, well above 90%. It's an astounding change. But we don't see that just for nuclear. We see that all across fuel types. We see it for coal. We see it for natural gas, et cetera, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the data shows that, and I use the phrase singing for their supper is the phrase I use, Brian, not just nuclear, but like you say, all fuel types and all power plants in a competitive market, you have to sing for your supper is the phrase that I use. You know, if you're not running and you're not operating, if you're not winning bids, if you're not winning contracts, if you're not, winning bilateral contracts with counterparties, you're not making, the profit or the margin that you want to make as an investor. So you have to sing for your supper. You have to win those contracts and those bids, be they ISO day ahead bids or be they counterparty bids for a fixed price, whatever bid you're trying to win, you have to win, profitable business for your company, for your investor, or you'll soon be out of business. Whereas in a monopoly state, I'm not saying that they're not trying. I'm not saying that they're not working hard. But, at the end of the day, they get a guaranteed rate of return if the commission deems that the investment was prudent and that the asset is used and useful, they get a guaranteed rate of return.
Okay. So have we talked about all of the other factors besides price that Phil looked at?
No, we haven't. So let me share my screen one more time just for a minute. Again, I know your audience can't see it, but, for you to see it will help me describe it. Let's see, share one more time. All right, so we've expanded to a few other areas. So first of all, in the area of reliability. So this is a really important one. Again, the same grouping, you recognize the grouping methodology of the competitive states versus the monopoly states. And utilities have six major reliability metrics that they report to EIA every year. and they started this in around 2015. So this doesn't go all the way back to 2008. They didn't start gathering these data points until 2015. So to make a long story short, if you're just glancing at this particular chart, the this chart is measuring one of the outage metrics called SAIDI. I forget what SAIDI stands for, but it's on the chart and defines it. But it's, you know, basically you want to have a low number here. You want to have a low outage, you know, average duration in minutes or frequency of outages. You know, you want to minimize both the frequency of the outages. You want to minimize the length of the outages, you know, common sense.
So what we have here is a bar graph that's just stunning in terms of measuring reliability between monopoly states and competitive states. And the black bars representing the monopoly states are towering over the green bars representing the competitive states.
Yeah, in this particular metric, that's true. If you look at the other metrics, it may not be quite as pronounced. But the point we're trying to refute here is the point that you hear all the time thrown out by the opponents of competitive markets or by the pro-monopoly group, the pro-monopoly crowd, as I call them. You know, they're like, oh, you know, if you allow competitive markets, you're, you know, introducing a lot of, reliability will suffer. Reliability will go down. Well, you know, again, if you look at the chart, this chart and the other ones, I'm not saying the reliability will improve. That would be too strong of a statement. I'm not saying that. But certainly the reliability is not worse. And in many cases, it is better, as this chart indicates. So clearly, they're just saying that the reliability goes down because it's not happening in real life.
Well, let's move down now. There's more to look at here.
Yeah, there's more. There's the utility financial performance. And so again, this is for the people who are concerned that the utility is going to go out of business, because sometimes the utility will say, well, we're going to go out of business and we're going to not be around to, you know, donate to your favorite charity or to your favorite organization, because our financial performance will go south if you force us to restructure.
And the bottom line here is it's clear that from both a credit rating perspective and a return on equity perspective, they're nearly identical across both categories.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very boring set of charts.
The next one I think is really, really important. That's reductions in emissions attributable to electric generation.
Yep, absolutely. I'm very pleased with this one. This is a relatively new one, just a couple of years. We've been measuring this one, again, expanding on Phil's work. But yes, bottom line is the green bar, again, is the emissions reductions in the competitive state as a group, and the black bar is monopoly. And the green bar is not a lot larger than the black bar. It's just a little. So it's not like blowing the monopoly states out of the water. But what I do want to say is, first of all, it is reducing emissions more. So that's a fact. But more importantly, or equally importantly on that statistic, is how are the competitive states doing it compared to the monopoly states are doing it with securitization payments, which you could also classify as stranded cost payments in many cases, to the vertically integrated utilities to close down prematurely before their life, you know, their total life cycle was expected to last on the coal plants. So they're doing it through securitization payments to the utilities, the monopoly states are, and they're doing it by guaranteeing a guaranteed rate of return to the utility to build the solar and the wind facilities, you know, that are contributing to the emissions reductions. The competitive states don't have either one of those vehicles available to them because the utilities, again, don't own the generation facilities in the competitive states. So how are the competitive states doing it? You know, they're doing it through, you know, private investment. I often talk to my friends and colleagues that live in different states. You know, I live in Illinois, like I mentioned. If you drive by the windmills and the solar farms in my state and you were to pull over and look at the fence and look at the nameplate of who owns the facility in Illinois, it's not the utilities. It's, you know, private investors, private developers. If you drive by in a monopoly state, the solar farms and the wind sites, you know, they're generally owned, not always, but they're often owned by the utility getting a guaranteed rate of return. So we're doing it. We're achieving these same objectives and even slightly more without resorting to those two types of financial incentives that the monopoly states have to resort to.
Let's talk about the price issue that we're dealing with right now in at least Massachusetts and Maryland, where I live. This whole idea that residential customers opting for a competitive supplier are paying more than if they stay with their default supplier. Do you want to elaborate on that issue?
Yeah, this is a terrible, terrible misunderstanding that's going on across the board. Yes, it's happening in Maryland and Massachusetts, you know, currently, but it's happened in other competitive states as well, you know, at different points in time. It's a very big misunderstanding that's just driving me crazy. So I appreciate the chance to comment on it, Brian, here. So there's been all these studies that have been done by different professors and different analysts that show during points in time and over periods of time, let's just say Maryland, for example, in this example, where retail suppliers have been charging more than the default service at certain points in time. And I will say, hey, that's true. That has happened. There are times when the retail suppliers can beat the default service, which is also true based on the way markets move and the market changes and the timing of the default service purchases compared to the timing of when the retail supplier makes their offer available. That's also true. But generally speaking, the retail suppliers have had difficulty competing with the default service, not just in Maryland, but in, you know, the other states where that exists. And I want to say that, what is default service anyway? You know, what is this thing called default service that we're comparing the retail suppliers against? You know, default service is the utility going out generally, you know, they have tariffs to describe this function, but it's basically them going out and buying the default service power in the competitive wholesale market that now exists in these restructured competitive states that we just got done talking about by definition. So they're basically buying the power from the same competitive wholesale market that the retail suppliers are buying their power from. We're all buying power from the competitive wholesale market to serve our customers. So why is it that the default service oftentimes, more than half the time, ends up being less expensive than what the retail suppliers are able to get? I mean, does that mean we're bad, or we're bad business people, or we're bad at forecasting our load, or we're bad at procuring the power, you know, whatever? What's the problem? Well, the problem is pretty simple. The problem is that a retail supplier has all these costs of employees, like me, for example. I'm an employee of a retail supplier, and I am paid. I get paid a salary, you know, to work on the projects that I work on. And we have folks that interact with the ISOs, and we have folks that interact in the legal sphere and in the regulatory sphere and in the sales and the marketing sphere. And all these costs that we have as employees of a retail supplier, we need to capture on top of the cost of that commodity of the wholesale power itself. And we call that margin. You know, that's a pretty common term. We have to add a cost on top of it. The utilities also have employees performing very similar functions. They're interacting with ISOs. They have state government affairs employees. They have lobbyists and, you know, rate analysts and lawyers. And, you know, they also have very similar functions. They have, you know, rent on their offices. They have IT support, whatever. They have the same kind of overhead costs on top of the commodity costs that we have as retail suppliers. And those employees, of course, are also paid. They're not working for free, but they're paid for, and those costs for those employee expenses are paid for primarily in the wires charge, the delivery service rates of those utilities. So that's where this cost disparity comes from primarily, is that the utilities are only including in their default service prices or rates the cost of the commodity itself, and they're not including all this additional cost of the overhead. And it's substantial. It's a big number. And a colleague of mine, Frank Lacey, has documented this and has done the rate analysis, and it's a significant number. And really, if you take that into account, it pretty much erases the cost disparity that's being, you know, disputed and debated. The problem comes in with the misunderstanding. Because the utility is procuring this power and making it available in the form of the default service tariffs, people assume that it's equivalent to the same type of rate based when they did own the generation 20 years ago. They assume that that's equivalent because it's coming from the utility in both cases. That's the wrong interpretation of what's going on there.
We had Frank Lacey on season one, talking about this, what he called the subsidy advantage that utilities have in offering default service versus a competitive supplier. And it's a real problem. It's not taken into account by those who are actively working to deny residential customers choice today. This goes to my pet peeve, which is that the markets outside of Texas are not structured properly to allow the full range of benefits to go to the residential customer. In Texas, they did what the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission have urged for decades. They've quarantined the utility from the supply market. The utility is a wires company. They don't supply the energy except to carry it on their wires on behalf of the supplier. We're going to have this argument to death. I got tired of it when I was at RESA. I got tired of trying to defend a model that I felt was not right. Until we get the model right, customers are going to continue to not get the full benefits of the market. And we see that in Texas in terms of innovation and storage. They're just blowing everybody's doors off in terms of installing storage. So sorry to get on my soapbox here, but
you're absolutely right. I'm going to push it even further than that. I'm equally, if not more, concerned, Brian. I agree with you 100%. But the problem is getting worse, not better, because in the competitive states, many times, because the retail suppliers are still facing this headwind against the subsidy that we described, so they're not able to offer, you know, all this innovative stuff like electric vehicle charging or battery storage or, you know, all these other cool things that are awesome, because there's, you know, still fighting this uphill battle against the subsidy. And so what happens is it actually gets worse when the commission of these states, and I don't want to name any states, but it's you could figure it out pretty easily. But when the state commission orders then the utility to offer an electric vehicle charging rate or a time of use rate on the default service side, and then they repeat the same problem with the subsidy. So like all the development costs that the utility will incur for developing a time of use rate or an electric vehicle charging rate or whatever the thing may be, all those costs of development to change the billing system and, you know, change, you know, update the website with the communications and the marketing materials end up in the wires charge. Again, so like even if we were to offer, we a retail supplier would offer something comparable, our costs would need to be recovered, you know, from our commodity price, you know, for that service, for that product. And the utility will again have a competitive advantage because all their costs are in the wires charge to develop such. So it's actually getting worse, not better. So we got to fix it. It's going to take a big effort to fix it. And we're going to have to, you know, all unify and work together, those who advocate for competitive markets. But at the end of the day, we're not trying to hurt the utility. The utility should recover their costs for sure. They should just recover them in the proper place, which is not in the wires charge.
Well, Rich, this has been a great conversation. I appreciate your making the time to try and break this down. And hopefully we haven't lost too many of our listeners by referring to graphs that are available on the RESA website. If they go into the transcript section of this episode, they'll be able to find links to all of these charts. As I do with all my guests, Rich, I'll leave it to you. If there's anything we haven't discussed here so far that you think is relevant and should be brought up for the good of the order, please do.
Well, yeah, just one last thing. First of all, I'm grateful, Brian, for you letting me share this information. I'm excited about sharing it. I hope that was evident in my comments. I have been working on this for a number of years. You know, what I want to share with your audience is more of a philosophical thing. And that is, you know, the people who brought competitive markets about, the Phil O'Connors of the world, the people of his generation, most of them have retired by now or, you know, or have even passed away, you know. And I think, you know, I was inspired by these folks, but I think it's kind of like my generation's duty. And I'll encourage people who are still in the industry, just like I am and have not retired. It's our duty to salvage and fix these problems. I mean, they introduced competitive markets. They got it off the ground. But now it's our job to fix the issues that have now emerged so that competitive markets will continue to thrive and can continue to produce these benefits that have already been produced. These are problems that can all be fixed. These are all And the markets are still working better, despite all these problems and all these issues we've brought forward. The data that we just got done talking about shows that the competitive markets are still doing a great job, but they could be doing an even greater job if we could fix some of these new problems that have emerged. So I just want to encourage everyone who's listening to, you know, get engaged in these efforts and help us to bring these ideas forward to fix the problems that we have and then to open up new markets to competition.
Yeah, it's a tough order in this age of disinformation that we live in. People don't read past the headline if they read the headline at all. And you mentioned the institutional knowledge gap that we have today. The regulators and policymakers who are dealing with these issues today, they don't have the depth of knowledge going back decades as someone like Phil O'Connor had. We need to educate people about what's going on now, but also what's happened in the past and how this is the only industry still standing with monopolies, really full monopolies. I mean, you've got monopoly problems in railroads, you've got monopoly problems in airlines, but for the most part, they are price deregulated. To try and meet the climate change threat 25 years into the 21st century, and we're still allowing monopolies to hinder progress, is a real problem. And lastly, I'll say Phil was just a wonderful communicator. He was a terrific advocate for competitive markets because he used facts and he demonstrated facts in a way that were accessible to the average person. And I congratulate you for walking in Phil's footsteps and trying to keep facts up rather than disinformation. Rich Spilkey with us today on behalf of the Retail Energy Supply Association. Thank you very much.